Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Jungle is Neutral. The epic true story of one man's war behind enemy lines. By F. Spencer Chapman. Narrated by Leighton Pugh.
About the author. Frederick Spencer Chapman, DSO, was born in 1907. He read English and history at Cambridge. Taking part in expeditions to Greenland and to Himalaya, Chapman made the first ascent of Chomolhari in 1937. When war broke out in 1939, he was a housemaster at Gordonston, where Prince Philip was one of his pupils. After the start of World War II, he was assigned to a special training centre as a commando instructor, and in September 1941, he was posted to Malaya to help organise local resistance against the impending Japanese invasion. It was the beginning of his career as a truly outstanding strategist of guerrilla warfare. His danger-filled 3 years and 4 months spent in the jungle with the Malayan people's anti-Japanese army are the theme of The Jungle is Neutral, and were full of action, peril, illness, and uncertain allies, but also appreciation of nature and the unique experience he was living through. At the end of the war, he was a civil affairs officer in Malaya until he was demobbed in 1946. He then returned to educational work. He was the organizing secretary of the Outward Bound Trust for a year before taking up teaching again as a headmaster. Chapman married Faith Townsend in 1946, and they had three children, Nicholas, Stephen, and Christopher. He died in 1971. Chapter 1. In Search of the War. When I left Sedba in 1926, I loathed the school OTC to such an extent that although I was a cadet officer and had taken Certificate A, I was determined I would never voluntarily form fours or polish my buttons again. In the early summer of 1939, however, when I was a housemaster at Gordonston School, Murrayshire, it became obvious, even to me, who rarely seemed to find time to read a newspaper, that war was coming, and on the advice of my headmaster, I, together with several other younger members of the staff, joined the local territorial battalion, the 4th and 5th Seaforth Highlanders, though I can lay claim to no Scottish blood. And in July of that year, we went to camp at Barry, near Dundee. As the territorials were then doubling their strength, I had a flying start as a lieutenant, by virtue of my Cert A, and because potential company commanders were at a premium. My only brother, and an uncle and his family, whom I had never met, lived in British Columbia, and since it looked as if it would be my last chance of visiting them for some time, I managed to persuade my commanding officer to let me go to Canada during the school summer holidays. I crossed the Atlantic as second steward on a grain ship bound for Hudson Bay, and when the war broke out on September the 3rd, I was staying with a cousin on Vancouver Island. Before returning, I had intended to visit the World Fairs at San Francisco and New York, and then to work my way back across the Atlantic on a cattle boat. The expenses of the whole expedition were to have been paid for by four lectures on Greenland and Tibet, which I had arranged to give at the World Fairs. When war broke out, I had, of course, to return by the quickest possible route, by train across Canada and then by liner, but I had not nearly enough money with me for this kind of travel. Fortunately, the CPR cashed a cheque for me, and I returned to Montreal and then boarded the Duchess of Richmond. After a fortnight's delay at Halifax, we returned in the first transatlantic convoy of the war, which followed a peculiar route south of the Azores and up past Cape Finisterre to the Mersey, being twice chased by German submarines on the way. When at last I joined my battalion, I found that it had divided into two, the 4th Seaforths being in the 51st Division and already preparing to go overseas with the BEF, and the 5th Seaforths being in the 9th Division, which was split up into small detachments whose duty it was to guard vital points in remote parts of the Northern Highlands. The 5th Battalion of the Seaforth Highlanders is that anomalous one that wears the Sutherland instead of the Mackenzie kilt, and has its own handsome and unusual cap badge. And I must admit that it was largely because of these peculiarities that I joined the 5th instead of the 4th. Had I joined the latter, I should, presumably, have been taken prisoner with the rest of the battalion at Saint-Valery, and I should never have gone near Malaya. Early in October, when I eventually joined my company, I found it guarding Everton Airfield near Invergordon. There I spent some weeks attending a strenuous young officer's course run by 2 regular sergeant majors who might have come straight from the pages of Punch. My next task, by virtue of having been a schoolmaster, was the training of more than 100 young recruits, known as the Army Class Intake, at Dingwall. I thoroughly enjoyed these months, being entirely responsible for the training, feeding and relaxation of these lads. I amply provide the axiom that the best way to learn is to teach, and in my subsequent years of irregular soldiering, I was almost most grateful for this thorough grounding in elementary tactics and weapon training. Most of the recruits were from Paisley and Renfrew, and their prowess as soccer players was outstanding. But what delighted me was that, though town dwellers, they so rapidly distinguished themselves by their skill in fieldcraft and on night schemes. This job was almost completed when my colonel received an order for me to report to the Admiralty forthwith. On arrival there, I discovered that naval intelligence were very interested in the extreme north of Scandinavia, and as I had twice driven reindeer across Lapland, it was proposed that I should visit these parts on a special mission. I had submitted my plan for carrying out their wishes, and it had already been approved when, on November the 30th, Russia invaded Finland. The Admiralty then had other ideas about Scandinavia, and I was returned to my battalion. In December, I attended a course at Scottish Command, Edinburgh, and was just about to be given command of a company when I was again ordered to report to London, this time to the War Office. I discovered that a ski battalion was being formed, and I was to advise on personnel and equipment. The month of January was spent in hectically equipping a battalion on the specialised lines of a polar expedition with skis, flown over from Zurich, and special winter bindings, Nansen sledges, made at an aircraft factory at Heston, and man-hauling gear, eiderdown sleeping bags, double pyramid tents, Grenfell cloth wind jackets, white on one side and fawn on the other, sealskin boots, to be flown over by the Hudson's Bay Company, snow glasses, sledging rations, and many other peculiar items of equipment, much of which had to be specially made in the shortest possible time. On February the 5th, the ski battalion, which was known as the 5th Scots Guards, started to assemble at Borden Camp, Aldershot. Instead of teaching a trained and disciplined body of soldiers to ski, the War Office had, except for one company of regular guardsmen, collected 1,000 skiers from every unit of the army, all branches of civil life, and from every part of the globe, and was faced with the formidable task of turning them into a fighting unit. Some of them could not even shoot. Indeed, a few were in uniform for the first time. On the other hand, there were 600 officers, volunteers from all arms of the service, including many majors and captains, some of whom had been recalled from commanding units in the BEF. Only a few of these, usually regular soldiers of many years' experience, could stay on as officers. The rest of us had to relinquish our commissions and enlist in the ranks as guardsmen. I, having designed the equipment, had the elevated rank of Staff Sergeant and was helped by J.M. Scott and Quintin Riley, while our department was taken over by Martin Lindsay, who, as a regular officer, had retained his commission. The four of us had all been members of Gino Watkins's Greenland expeditions, and spent our time either giving dress rehearsals of polar camping technique in the gymnasium, or fitting winter bindings to skis, and packing up our incredibly varied and fragile assortment of equipment in the goods sheds at Aldershot. The battalion was due to embark for an unknown destination at the beginning of March, and there were thus only 3 weeks for assembly, organisation, documentation, medical inspection, training, and equipping. On March the 2nd, the battalion, half-trained though it was, embarked at Southampton, and a few days later, much to our surprise, reached Chamonix in the French Alps, where we started intensive ski training with the Chasseurs Alpins, the well-known skiers Bill Bracken and Patsy Richardson, who were also sergeants, set about teaching the company of regular guardsmen to ski, and the four of us, with Arctic experience, ran courses of instruction in sledging technique for the officers and NCOs of each company. Unfortunately, the winter bindings, so laboriously put on in readiness for low-temperature work in Scandinavia, were useless on the hard snow and extremely steep runs at Chamonix, and we had to set up a ski shop to refit each man's boots and bindings. After less than a fortnight at Chamonix, we were once more told to entrain, with full equipment, for an unknown destination. 3 days later, after a miserably uncomfortable journey, we found ourselves together with the rest of a specially equipped division on board ship at Glasgow, bound for Scandinavia. But on March the 12th, Finland had signed a peace with Russia. We were sent back in deep depression to our old quarters at Borden and were disbanded. Once again I returned, rather shamefacedly, to my battalion. In the middle of April, a letter reached my colonel from Scottish Command, ordering me to report at Regimental Headquarters, Coldstream Guards, London, and be prepared to proceed to Paris. The message ended, enigmatically, "His ultimate destination is unknown." The Coldstream Guards knew nothing about me or my ultimate destination, but suggested I should try the Scots Guards. Here I met Colonel Coates, the CO of the late ski battalion, and learned that three of us were to return at once to Chamonix. A mountain division was being formed to fight in Norway, and was to be trained in Haute-Savoie. This time it had been decided to turn trained soldiers into mountaineers, and we were being sent ahead to choose a suitable training area and make the necessary preparations. Once there, we were again attached to the 199th Battalion of the Chasseurs Alpins, and, while the other two stayed in Chamonix, wrestling with problems of liaison, billeting and commissariat, I had to study equipment, training and tactics. For this purpose, I was attached to the Éclaireur, or Scout, section of the Chasseurs, which included, among other expert skiers, Émile Allais, downhill champion of Europe. Our headquarters were first at the Promontoire hut beside the Mer de Glace, and later at the Requin hut at 8,300 feet. Each day we would go on ski patrol to the Col du Géant to keep an eye on the Italians, or far up the creviced snows of Mont Blanc. On May the 10th, 1940, my 33rd birthday, we actually reached the summit of Mont Blanc, the highest point in the Alps. But it was on that very day that the Germans invaded Holland and Belgium, and a few days later we flew back from Paris to Croydon. My next posting was to a parachute battalion, the 60th Queens, once more commanded by Colonel Coates and officered by the nucleus of the ski battalion. But this, again, was soon disbanded, because, we were told, there were no parachutes. The RAF, not unreasonably, needed all there were. My only consolation was that I had at last become a captain. At the end of June, not daring to return to my battalion again, I had myself posted to the special training centre, Loch Islet, on the west coast of Scotland, and here, since Norway had just been evacuated and there was no actual fighting going on, was a job after my own heart. This school, the prototype of the many commando and guerrilla warfare schools that were soon to spring up in this country and overseas, originated in a curious way. In May 1940, a submarine was chartered for a secret operation on the Norwegian coast. In the party were Brian Mayfield, who had been second in command of the ski battalion, Jim Gavin, one of its company commanders with whom I had been associated in a projected attempt on Mount Everest for 1940, and Bill Sterling. In the middle of the North Sea, they were detected by a German submarine, depth-charged, and so severely damaged that they only just succeeded in limping back on the surface to scupper. To recuperate, the whole party went to stay at Bill Sterling's house in Scotland, and there they decided to start a training centre for smash-and-grab raids on targets in enemy-occupied territory, a sideline which, after Dunkirk, seemed the only possible form of offensive warfare. The War Office approved the plan, and so the Special Training Centre came into being with Lieutenant Colonel Mayfield as CO and Major Sterling as Chief Instructor. Gavin was in charge of demolitions, and Major the Lord Lovett, a cousin of Bill Sterling's, came in as a field craft instructor. In this he was helped by Bill's younger brother, David, who later became the originator and leader of the Special Air Service. After taking the course myself, I worked with Lovett on the field craft side and later became assistant chief instructor. At that time, our chief function was to train cadres of independent companies. Commandos of 500 were then thought to be too cumbersome, and each was being split into two independent companies. Later, this policy was reversed. Who were billeted at Arisaig, Glenfinnan, Mora, and various other shooting lodges in the neighbourhood. The whole of this part of the West Coast was made a prohibited area, and except for the excessive rainfall, provided an ideal place for such training. Jim Gavin and Michael Calvert, also of the ski battalion, later Brigadier Calvert, DSO, better known as Mad Mike, ran the demolition wing with tremendous originality and enthusiasm, continually devising and trying out new gadgets. In the weapon training wing, every sort of British and foreign firearm was experimented with, and Messrs. Fairbairn and Sykes, of Shanghai police fame, converted a derelict cottage into a sinister revolver range, where targets suddenly appeared in the half-light and had to be engaged from any position. The fieldcraft training was based on the traditional lore of the Lovett Scouts, with plenty of practical map reading and direction finding, especially at night, stalking, the enthusiasm of students being first aroused with deer stalking, long-range observation with the telescope, and a minute study of the technique of ambush, assisted by lively demonstrations. The standard army equipment we found too cumbersome, and our patrols were given rubber footwear, the mountaineer's rucksack and lightweight tent, and the polar explorer's concentrated rations. Each course ended with a most arduous and realistic 2 days and nights scheme over rough and difficult country, round Lochs, Beauraid, and Mora. One day I was asked if I would like to go to Australia on a mission that was being sent to form and train Australian and New Zealand independent companies. I was quite certain that the Japs were shortly coming into the war, and there seemed just as much chance of getting some fighting from Australia as from the British Isles. Also, and perhaps this was the greatest incentive, I should see the only continent that I had not yet visited. So I said yes. The mission consisted of Lieutenant Colonel Moorhood, in charge, Mike Calvert, demolitions, myself, fieldcraft, and two regular sergeants, who were experts on weapon training and signals, respectively. In August 1940, I left Loch Eilert. I went down to Farnborough to take a course in the interpretation of air photographs, an important aspect of fieldcraft, and on October the 6th, No. 104 military mission left Newport on SS Rimutaka, bound for the Antipodes. In a remarkable journey, we crossed the extreme North Atlantic to Bermuda, thence, via Curaçao, the Panama Canal and Pitcairn Island to Auckland, Wellington, Sydney, and finally Melbourne. The idea of Anzac independent companies, or commandos, was not a new one, and it was shrouded in so much secrecy that nothing effective could be done for some time. We talked vaguely of guerrilla and irregular warfare, of special and paramilitary operations, stay-behind parties, resistance movements, sabotage and incendiarism, and, darkly and still more vaguely, of agents. But the exact role of the commandos and independent companies had never been made very clear. The recent Lofoten raid was much in people's minds, and some thought, and hoped, that the companies would be used as shock troops for full-scale raids with air and sea support. Others, with more imagination, though one must not be wise after the event, realised that if war came to the Pacific, the Jap, who was said to have been secretly preparing for years, might at first, if the Americans did not sink his fleet on the way, overrun certain islands. The role of the companies would then be to stay behind, live off the country or be provisioned by air, and be a thorn in the flesh of the occupying enemy, emerging in true guerrilla style to attack vital points, and then disappear again into the jungle. We also visualised long-range penetration of the enemy lines by parties so highly skilled in fieldcraft and in living off the country that they could attack their targets and get back again without being detected. The most subtle interpretation of their role was that small parties or even individuals should be left behind, infiltrated, or parachuted into country which was occupied or about to be occupied by the enemy, to work with the natives of the country in active sabotage, to keep alive the spirit of resistance, and to act as a nucleus force for raiding parties who would be sent in from outside. At last, early in 1941, after looking at various sites that had been offered, we decided on Wilson's Promontory at the extreme south point of Victoria. Wilson's Promontory was a national park, and therefore uninhabited, except by a few rangers and great numbers of kangaroos, wallabies and emus. And as it was joined to the mainland by a 20-mile isthmus of sand and scrub, its security was perfect. The promontory itself was about 20 miles long and half as wide, and included every possible type of ground, high mountains and rock crags culminating in Mount Latrobe, 2,475 feet, eucalyptus forest as dense, especially the secondary growth after a fire has been through, as any tropical jungle, rolling open grassland and scrub, sand dunes, mud flats, and every kind of swamp. Also harbours, beaches and islands for combined operations, and even a landing field, which was being enlarged to take bombers. It was therefore ideally suited for training troops who might fight anywhere from the Libyan deserts to the jungles of New Guinea, the only drawback being that in winter, as it was so far south, the climate was often more polar than tropical. Our courses lasted 6 weeks, and each one included the officers and NCOs of one Australian and one New Zealand independent company, about 60 men. The training was the natural development of the Lock Islet course, and was as practical as we could make it. Calvert, with his infectious enthusiasm, taught them how to blow up everything from battleships to brigadiers, and I can see now the gleam that used to come into his eyes as he looked at a bridge and worked out exactly how much explosive to use and where to place it. I taught them how to get a party from A to B and back by day or night in any sort of country and to arrive in a fit state to carry out their task. This included all sorts of sidelines, a new conception of fitness, knowledge of the night sky, what to wear, what to take and how to carry it, what to eat and how to cook it, how to live off the country, tracking, memorizing routes, and how to escape if caught by the enemy. The course culminated in a 3-day and night scheme in which the Australians fought the New Zealanders all over the promontory, and this was followed by a heated post-mortem on a 12-foot square sand table model of the area. I shall never forget the extraordinary enthusiasm and ingenuity shown on these schemes, and not only because, as umpires, Calvert and I were dragged through the deepest swamps and most impenetrable thickets. By the end of July 1941, we had chosen and trained our successors, and the Australians were ready to take over the school. In August, Calvert was posted to the Bush Warfare School, Maemyo, Burma, and I to No. 101 Special Training School, Singapore. Chapter 2. War Comes to Malaya. To foster resistance movements in the Far East brings one up against many problems not encountered in Europe. The native populations are a hodgepodge of various racial, religious, and political elements, and among them include the colonies of 3 major European powers. What patriotic or ideological driving force could such countries have to help them to resist an invader? Again, no European can live for a day in an Asiatic country without being recognized as a white man. Therefore, unless a safe area among a friendly people can be found, a European must be perpetually in hiding, with obvious bad effects on his health and morale. And if he operates at night or in disguise, the strain will be even greater. There is also the problem of language. Few Englishmen can speak Siamese, Chinese, Karen, or even Malay like a native. Then there are almost insuperable geographical difficulties. A country like Burma or Sumatra has in its mountainous or swampy jungles an infinite number of hiding places where guerrillas can go to ground, but life is very precarious and unhealthy in such places, even for a native, much more so for a white man. Food is hard to get, distances are vast, and communications difficult. It may take a month's hard travelling, even for a fit party, to cover a distance of 100 miles on the map. So vast are the distances that there may be no possibility of supplying the guerrillas with arms and other equipment, or of the interchange of agents. Malaya, for example, until the arrival of the new Liberator bomber in 1944, was out of range of any available plane flying from any base in India or Ceylon except the old Catalina seaplane, which is far too slow and vulnerable for modern warfare. And the west coast of Malaya is so shelving as to be almost inaccessible to submarines. Finally, it must be realized that in 1941 the High Command in Malaya were not in the least interested in guerrilla warfare in any of its forms. At that time, the war in Europe had set no example of a successful resistance movement, and there were too many at Far Eastern headquarters who still thought in terms of the last war. The idea of stay-behind parties consisting of Europeans and Asiatics seemed an extravagant and impracticable notion. The defence of Malaya was considered to be a purely military undertaking, and to be already well under control through the proper channels. Early in 1941, a small organisation had been sent out to Singapore to deal with certain aspects of irregular warfare. No. 101 Special Training School was the instructional and operational arm of this organisation, and was commanded by Lieutenant Colonel J. M. L. Gavin, R.E. His school in Singapore had only been going for 6 weeks when I arrived by air from Sydney, early in September 1941, as his second-in-command. Later, I was to take over from Gavin, leaving him free to go on tour and concentrate on the planning side. The war establishment of the school consisted of 10 officers and about 50 other ranks. Of these, the specialists came out with Gavin, and the rest had been recruited locally. The object of the school was to train all types of personnel, military and civilian, European and native, in irregular warfare, and to supply special intelligence and carry out certain operations at the orders of GHQ Far East, with whom Lieutenant Colonel A. Warren, RM, was the liaison officer. By December the 8th, plans were well underway for directing irregular warfare in China and for stable...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?